As Jesus carries on through the gospel according to John, teaching and speaking to his disciples, they sometimes seem to become more and more baffled. And sometimes I think John the evangelist writing the gospel is perfectly comfortable with us being baffled. Sometimes it's not a morality tale, it's not a lesson. It's not 3 points to make an argument. It's not an epic or an archetype or a tone poem. Sometimes it's neither a treatise to be debated or an image to be interpreted. Sometimes it just is what it is. I used to hate that saying. Of course it is what it is. That's why it is. But I think I've come to recognize the truth buried in it. Sometimes it just is what it is. Mary and Martha's brother, Lazarus, had been in the tomb for 4 days by the time Jesus arrived at the outskirts of their village. Many of us had come to be with Martha and Mary to offer consolation. We were their people, the ones called the Jews. Sometimes people use that name with respect and religious acknowledgement. Sometimes people, including evangelists, use it almost as a curse or an epithet when they talk about us, and sometimes people spit it directly in our faces as if it were an insult. That's their fault, but they tend to make it our problem, which, when the day of reckoning comes, will be their problem. But I digress. We were there with Martha and Mary to console them after the death and burial of their brother, Lazarus. When word came that Jesus was near, Martha went out and met him first while Mary stayed in the house. He and Martha spoke briefly, and then she came back and said something to Mary, and we who were in the house consoling her saw Mary get up to go somewhere. So we got up to go with her. I think we all thought that she was going to the tomb to continue her grieving there. And of course, we were all crying with her and had no intention of letting her go there alone in that state. Well, it turned out she wasn't going to the tomb. She was going to see Jesus in the same place where Martha had just been with him. When Mary got there, she knelt at his feet and she said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." He saw her weeping. And he saw us wiping tears from our eyes and choking back sobs. And it looked for all the world, I kid you not, like he himself was greatly disturbed in spirit and deeply, deeply moved. And in that condition, he asked Mary where the body of her brother, his friend, had been laid to rest. I didn't want Mary to have to deal with that question. I figured we could walk him through the logistics. So some of us said, "Lord, come and see." Did you know that when Jesus was first calling disciples, 2 of John the Baptist's disciples followed Jesus. When he turned around and saw that they were following him, he asked what they were looking for. And they asked him, "Rabbi, where are you staying?" And he said to them, "Come and see." And they came and saw and stayed with him that day. Did you know that right around that time, Philip had also started following Jesus, went and found Nathanael, told him they had found the one about whom Moses and the prophets had written, the son of Joseph from Nazareth. And Nathanael said, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" And Philip said, "Come and see." Did you know that when Jesus had his encounter with the woman at the well, she ran into the city and said to everybody she could find, "Come and see a man who told me everything I have ever done. He can't be the Messiah, can he?" Doesn't it seem like every time someone has just had, is having, or is about to have a personal experience of being near this magnetic man, whose love and acceptance and whose very presence seem to turn this lost, disoriented world upside down, or more accurately, right side up, Somebody's voice is always there issuing the invitation. Come and see. And now we were saying it right back to him. He said, where have you laid him? We said, Lord, come and see. And as God is my witness, he started crying again. And we said, look how he loved him. But there were a couple in our group who said, wait a minute, couldn't he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? You just kind of let that hang there. It wasn't my job to come up with an answer. And that doesn't mean that I do or don't think it's a worthy question or a piece of rhetoric that kind of lands in your face. It was just somebody else's question or rhetorical statement. So we left it there. When he came to the tomb, he was again what the Greeks call embrimomenos en alto, being deeply moved within, literally groaning in himself. And we all saw it. And pulling himself together, he said, take away the stone. Martha said, Lord, I don't think you want to do that. 4 days, as the King James Version reports it. She said, by this time, Lord, he stinketh. He said, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? And in a loud voice, he called for Lazarus to come out. And the dead man came out. And Jesus told us, unbind him and let him go. Many of us who were there and saw what had just happened believed in him. But some who had been with us went and told the religious authorities what he had done. And later we heard that the chief priests and Pharisees called a meeting of the council. Obviously, this was a problem. Giving somebody life apparently was a problem. And they were saying, what are we going to do? We let this guy go on like this, everybody's going to believe in him. Then the Romans are going to come and destroy both our holy place and our nation. But those of us who were there that day, when Jesus successfully called a dead person back to life, couldn't help telling the world about what we'd seen. When others heard about it, about the sign that he had done, they came out to meet him. And it was a huge crowd. And that's when I heard the Pharisees saying to each other, you see that? And you can't do anything about it. Look, the whole world has gone after him. The world, the Greek word is cosmos. It's the whole world, which as far as we knew was the whole created universe as we knew it. Everything and everybody under heaven. The inhabitants and all the affairs of the world. That's what that word meant. The very same word John used 4 times in a row when he said, the true light which enlightens everyone was coming into the world. Not just the place, but all that we are, all that happens and all that is in the world. He was in the world and the world came into being through him, yet the world did not know him. John the Baptist had seen Jesus coming toward him and said, here is the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. This whole thing, this whole mess we've made. God so loved the world that he gave his only Son that everyone who believes in him may not perish but have eternal life. God, Jesus said, did not send the Son into the world to condemn the world but in order that the world might be saved through him. Jesus said, as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Not just the physical planet, but the people and the lives and the realities that exist on it. I am the light of this world. I am the light of everybody under heaven. You, me, the people that we love, the people that we fear, the people that we don't like very much. the light of everything that exists in the world, the light of everything about the world and everything that happens in the world, the light of the totality of the world. And the Pharisees saw that people were flocking to him because of what they had heard about him and what some of us had seen with our own eyes. And they said, look at that. And we can't even stop it anymore. The world has gone after him. It's almost as if he had waited until everybody was on board, till people from all walks of life and from cultures and backgrounds beyond his own family, his own culture, his own people was on board before he could do what he knew that he came to do. Among those who went up to worship at the festival this time were some Greeks. Not his own people, the Jews, but some who came from outside the tradition and the family of the covenant people, the people of God who'd been led through the wilderness for 40 years and had settled in the promised land. The Greeks were not part of that family. But some Greeks now came to Philip, the disciple, and they said, Phil, they didn't say that, they said, sir, we wish to see Jesus. Philip went and told Andrew, then Andrew and Philip both went and told Jesus, and that's when he said to them, the hour has come. The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Whose time? Now it was clearly not just about the salvation of one people, but the salvation of all people. The whole world. When you wonder if God remembers that you exist, or when you are hoping that God is not watching you, when it feels like everybody else is in on the big secret and you alone are left in the dark, when even your closest friend seems distant, when the stress of expectations and homework and bills and relationships and medical insurance and doctor's reports stack up around you, when your only companion is an aching loneliness, when everything is just too much to handle, that is you being in the world. That is the specific world that Jesus came specifically to save. You are not only in the world that Jesus came to reach out for, you are the world that Jesus came to reach out for. And those Pharisees were right. The world has heard the news now, and they can't do a thing in the world to stop it. You can distract the church with divisive issues that have extremely little to do with Christ's love for the world, but that won't stop it. You can ignore God's demands for love and for justice for the poor and for hospitality to the immigrant, commands that permeate both the Old and the New Testaments, but that won't stop it. You can store away the good news, hide it away like canisters of nuclear waste buried under tons of concrete, in decaying structures that may have worked 50 or 100 years ago, but mean practically nothing to anybody under 25. But that won't stop it. The whole world, the cosmos, is going after him. The only thing left that they could think of to do was to try to get rid of him altogether. Put him on a cross. Affix him so permanently and make it so sordidly, repulsively aggressive. Nail him to it if we have to, that everyone will know that this guy is not coming back from crucifixion. Put him in a tomb with the largest stone you can find to go right in front of the door so that people will know he is never getting out. And death will be the final word. Let's see, they will say, if he can turn the world upside down now. Maybe we finally found a way to stop the world from going after him. It's Palm Sunday, a week from today, and that begins Holy Week, which will include Maundy Thursday, which is the commemoration of the Last Supper, and Good Friday, which is the most somber day of the Christian year, which is when we remember his crucifixion. and then we'll wait for resurrection on Saturday. Sometimes it's not a morality tale. It's not a lesson. It's not a three-point argument. It's not an archetype or an epic or a tone poem. Not a treatise for debate. Not an image to be interpreted. Sometimes it just is what it is. And the people of God, and the people who call God other names, and the people who don't even believe in God, and the people who don't know God at all, which is to say, in a word, the world, is simply invited to come and see.